Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our churning politics these days provide a perfect teachable moment for American civics. From the national debate over filling a vacant seat on the Supreme Court to local laws requiring people to wear masks, it's all one big civics lesson, and our guests today want you to be ready. We're talking this hour with the hosts of NHPR's podcast, Civics 101. For 4 years, the show has explored and explained concepts fundamental to our republic. And now, just in time for the election, co-hosts Hannah McCarthy and Nick Cappadice have written a new book called A User's Guide to Democracy, How America Works. Exchange listeners, let's get your Civics 101 questions in right now. You can send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And along with Hannah and Nick, we're also joined by Martha Mattson, Executive Director for the New Hampshire Institute for Civics Education. Well, welcome to all of you. And Nick, I want to start with you. Sometimes current events push us into learning more about our civics than we might want to. Right now, we're in one of those moments. Over the weekend, the president announced his choice of Amy Coney Barrett to fill the U.S. Supreme Court seat of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last weekend. Nick, to you first. What's the importance of having 9 justices seated very quickly? Because this keeps getting emphasized, and this nomination came very quickly.
Yes, it did indeed. So, goodness me. So to start off, if you have 8 justices in the Supreme Court, you're going to have a tie, which, you know, you don't want to have in a, you don't want to have a tie. You want to have as few ties as possible in the Supreme Court. But what's interesting is just sort of how nebulous the Constitution is on this, specifically when it comes to the judicial branch. Article 3 in the Constitution, which deals with the judicial branch, says extremely little on what the Supreme Court actually does. It doesn't say how many justices there are. It just says there has to be a chief justice, but it doesn't even say what the chief justice should do. The Supreme Court's main power was bestowed upon itself by itself in the very, very famous case of Marbury v. Madison, when the Supreme Court sort of became the arbiter of constitutional law. So what we're looking at here right now with this nomination is sort of two sort of governmental processes. We're looking at the powers and processes of the Supreme Court, and we're looking at the powers of the Senate in Article 2 under the Advice and Consent Clause, sort of how do Supreme Court justices get appointed to the bench. And those are the two systems that we're looking at now.
So, Nick, why don't you want a tie on the Supreme Court? What happens if there is a really important case and there's a tie?
Well, my goodness, if there's a tie, it's a split. You have a split court, and you don't want to have a split court because then things don't get resolved. They have to get, it's quite rare for there to be a split court. The vast majority of Supreme Court decisions are unanimous, which kind of surprised me when I first learned that. But you don't want it to go back down to the lower courts for retrial or come back to the court again.
Hannah, what are you thinking about, you know, watching this moment as the co-host of the Civics podcast? And congratulations, by the way, the co-author of this new book. What are you sort of thinking about right now, Hannah, in terms of this Supreme Court process?
I think what's really fascinating, and getting back to the nebulousness of the description of the Supreme Court in the Constitution, is the fact that, of course, Congress is in charge of how many justices there can be on the bench. And they have changed that number over the course of history. We have had as many as 10. We started out with 6. And in this particular moment in history, you do hear a lot of Democrats talking about court packing, which is something that FDR in particular tried to get through in his New Deal legislation era, because the Supreme Court was not ruling in his favor on all of these laws. He wanted to add as many as another 6 justices, which can be done by an act of Congress. We could have 100 if Congress could pass that act. So you're really seeing this fascinating moment in history where the rubber might meet the road with court packing. If there is a democratic control and an act goes through, you could potentially see a larger Supreme Court. And of course, that is something that the Supreme Court itself may end up weighing in on. So it's a fraught moment, but I'm watching with bated breath to see what happens here.
Wow, Hannah, that's really interesting. So the concept of 9 on the bench, that seems fixed in stone, but you just told us at one point we had 6, at one point we had 10. Democrats are also talking about, hey, if we get back in power, we might get rid of this no lifetime, lifetime appointments thing. That's another thing that they're talking about possibly changing. And Nick, all the analysts are talking about the ideology of the court and how this nomination will change it. How did the founders, Nick, view this branch and whether it would be quote unquote political or ideological?
Well, ideology is a very important thing to talk about when we're talking about what's going on from over the weekend. The founders did not envisioned, honestly, the Supreme Court to be the, quote, weakest branch, the least powerful of the three. It didn't have the power of the coin or the sword, right? But when we're talking about ideology, it is really important to think about if we had a court with the structure of, say, which we could have, 6-3, 6 conservative, 3 more liberal leaning justices. This does not just affect the outcome of cases that come to the Supreme Court. More crucially, this affects what cases can even be heard by the Supreme Court. It's called a committee of 4. A committee of 4 decides what cases that rise up, that petition for a writ of certiorari, which is how a case gets to the Supreme Court. 4 of the 9 justices choose what cases to hear in the first place. So if you have a court that leans very heavily 6-3 one way or the other, they can even just prevent a whole swath of cases from even being heard, from even getting to that point. I have never seen it in my lifetime. Maybe some folks out there who are calling in have, but it's totally new territory for me.
Speaking of calls, perfect segue, Nick. Thank you very much.
I want
to invite listeners to join us at 1-800-892-6477. It is your chance, Exchange listeners, to ask your civics questions, whether about the Supreme Court process, the Electoral College, local versus federal versus state powers. Join us again at 1-800-892-6477 or by email exchange@nhpr.org. And Hannah, Nick, Martha, let's go to the phones. And Dave's calling in from Winchester. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, guys. I sure wish we were an independent country in New Hampshire. We wouldn't have to worry about this. But in terms of the court being tied, you were talking about how a tie is a bad thing. I've always thought that gridlock at the federal level is a good thing because they're not getting as much done. But how do you make the case for a tie being a bad thing?
Yeah, go ahead, Nick. That was your point.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, a tie, what happens in a tie in the Supreme Court is the decision of the lower court is upheld. And I think I misspoke when I said it's a bad thing. I just feel like if there are perpetual ties and then the lower court's decisions are perpetually upheld, that there's no interpretation of the law or the Constitution. From a sort of civics educator perspective, I'm always interested in how the Supreme Court settles these national issues. So if you have a circuit court, one of our, 13 circuit courts disagrees with a different circuit court, then you have this circuit split. You have this question unanswered in the minds of the American. You have a couple states who say a certain thing is legal and a couple states that say it isn't. And when the Supreme Court settles those disputes, in my mind, I always think it's better to have sort of a national cohesion to that.
Although it's interesting, if you like what the lower court said, right, Nick, then you're good with a tie at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you like the lower courts, our top appellate court, then that could suit you perfectly.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling. And again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Martha Mattson, I want to bring you into this. You said recently in an interview with the Union Leader that the coronavirus pandemic means we're living through the greatest civics lessons of our lifetimes right now. So, wow, Martha, what did you mean by that?
I think what I meant, and I think it's become even more dramatic since then, is that by necessity, we are learning about civics. We are observing the powers of the governors in our nation and how they interact with the federal government We're observing how individual choice, such as mask wearing, social distancing, things like that, how that is connected with the common good and the tension between those individual rights and the common, you know, the general welfare. So that's what I meant. I think we're all, like you said, whether we like it or not, we're learning more about civics and civic engagement.
Give us an example. I mean, you gave a couple there, Martha, but dive into one of those examples for us, please. You know, whether it's you can only gather in, you know, groups of 10 or 5, or, you know, you can't go into a retail store without a mask. Many cities have these laws right now. What examples really jump to mind for you as a civics educator, Martha?
Well, I think, you know, as Justice Souter said back in 2012, when he gave a talk about civics education, there's always a tension. You know, there are rights and ideals that are important to us as Americans, but oftentimes they're in conflict, right? And there's no absolute right of free speech because it's balanced out with other factors like the general welfare, the common good, safety and security. And, you know, sometimes we sacrifice our privacy for security. So I think it's important that we understand what those values are that connect us as Americans, but also understand that they also at times are balanced out by other important values. So I just think that we're all faced with those decisions every day. You may feel that, you know, wearing a mask is that's an imposition on your personal freedom. That the government should not ever be telling you what to wear on your face and where to go. But on the other hand, in an emergency, at times we do lose some of our individual freedoms, and it's happened, you know, throughout history in order to secure the general welfare and the health of the community. So that's what I meant. And also, you know, the federal government, to use that example, has really put this responsibility on individual states, and individual states are each making their own policies for the most part about this emergency.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I've got friends and family in France and Germany, and they're always asking me, what's with the 50 different policies that you have? And Hannah, I'd love your thoughts too. How has your podcast been exploring this intersection of the pandemic with civics?
Yeah, I mean, this was really interesting. What happened at the show is that, you know, we've always been a show that is not necessarily trying to directly respond to the news. We want to provide the very basics of democracy and stay as nonpartisan as possible. And we sort of saw that nonpartisanship as also meaning that we are not going to directly respond to anything, to be too hot buttony. However, this pandemic hits and you've got all of these questions, I think, especially for school children who are very confused, perhaps about how it is that you can have orders coming from the governor and not from the president that may dictate that you do something in your state, for example. So, you know, the first episode, I guess, post-pandemic hit, post-shutdown, post-quarantine, was on the emergency powers of the governor, how it is that you can indeed be ordered to do something by your governor and have to comply with that, and sort of getting into how federalism is rolling in this moment of emergency. But we're also covering, you know, the United States Post Office, something at top of mind for a lot of people, how it operates and how it connects all of us and how we rely upon it. And then we covered voting, because voting is going to look a lot different for a lot of people this year, and access to voting is going to be very different. So we were trying to find ways in which we could basically empower our listeners to better understand this particularly strange moment that we're all living through. And, you know, at the same time, we covered things like how to protest and what protest is and the ways in which it's protected and the ways in which it is not. And then the principle of posse comitatus, which prevents the government from sending a militarized force into the states unless the president sort of empowers himself to do so. And we're looking at these very specific, very strange things with the show, which has been totally illuminating for me. It's a different way of approaching Civics 101. But I do hope that we've been serving the listener better by doing so.
Well, and, you know, we all learn in high school about the principle of federalism. but Nick, we're really seeing it now, you know, the idea that in some instances, it's really kind of up to the states, and your experience with this pandemic depends on which state you live in, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Federalism was sort of the largest chapter in the book. And it was a very long episode when we did an episode on federalism, because, you know, we really are in a strange way, 50 separate governments. I mean, I say that sort of tongue in cheekily, because, you know, we are a republic, right? We're not a federation. But the different states' interpretation of these laws is fascinating. And what we try to encourage our listeners to do across the country, not just in New Hampshire, is to examine specifically how their state operates. Hannah mentioned voting. It's quite easy to forget that the people you vote for local and state office are the ones who decide how your vote is going to go down in November. So if you are frustrated with the system of voting, if you don't like how voting happens in your state, be it New Hampshire or another state, your different states have different ways of deciding how votes happen, how many polling stations there are, how ballots are counted, what kind of machines to use. Do you need a voter ID? Can you do same day registration? It's different in every state. So you got to look at how your state runs things and who's in charge of it if you want your vote to make a difference.
Well, all of you, as we've been saying, there's so much going on right now that calls us to better understand our civics. And we've been talking about the Supreme Court, the pandemic. We'll talk about voting a little bit later. But Martha, I want to ask you about the transition of political power after an election. Let's take that one. President Trump reiterated Thursday that he may not honor the results should he lose re-election. Many Americans, especially state elections officials, were alarmed. But most Republican leaders on Capitol Hill said there is no cause for alarm. Quote, "We will have a peaceful transfer of power like we always do." That was the general message. What does the Constitution, Martha, say about the peaceful transfer of power?
Well, I think it assumes that. There are presidential elections set up every 4 years. And there's a limit. The 22nd Amendment limits the terms that the number of terms that a president can hold is 2 terms. And it also gives the power of the election, you know, that election process to states, and that the federal government must honor what the states decide state by state. So I think it's implied, and it's always been the case that we've had that, except obviously the revolution was not peaceful. but the whole Constitution is set up as a system of rules and laws, so that the Constitution and the laws are what rule, not individual people who rule by pure power, like a monarch or a dictator. So our whole system is set up to avoid that kind of non-peaceful, violent transfer of power.
So let's talk more about civics education itself. And I want to ask you, Martha, about the work that you've been doing. But before we do, Hannah, I have to ask you as well how you on the podcast might deal with this new issue of, peaceful transfer of power. So go ahead, Hannah.
We're actually considering doing an episode on the peaceful transfer of power. This is something that the Senate recently unanimously affirmed in a resolution, a commitment to the peaceful transition of power. It is something that, as Martha said, is implied in the Constitution. And the idea there is that it is upholding the will of the people. So if we are, as a show, always trying to get at what our democracy is and how the basic principles enshrined in the Constitution, when upheld, protect that democracy and the health of that democracy. I think this subject in particular, and the fact that throughout history up until this point, every president has essentially committed to that peaceful transition of power. And, you know, when it comes to top of mind, when you have a president who suggests that that may not be the case, we're going to explore a little bit. You know, though every president, as far as we could tell, has seemed to commit to it, you know, we don't yet know the stories behind all of that. So part of our job is to dig a little bit deeper into the anecdotes and explore whether or not we've ever had another moment in history where the peaceful transition of power was ever in question.
Yeah. And if I could just jump in, if I could jump in on that real quick, Laura. Yeah. So one thing we all have to continue to remember is that the executive branch is the largest employer in the world, right? You're talking 4 million people who work under the executive branch, at which the very top is the president of the United States. So even if we weren't dealing with what we're dealing with now, which is the even just the faintest suggestion of not having a peaceful transition of power, it takes a ton of work and a ton of time to make that transition happen. People have started working on it months and months ago, because you think about it, you need to get everybody security clearance. That takes weeks and weeks to get everybody who's working under you to security clearances. You've got to plan so much for the organizational switch. So this just even bare suggestion is truly a wrench in the works.
Well, and I know you and Hannah are planning a podcast episode about it, and the Exchange is going to be looking at it probably next week. So we'll set it aside for now. But Martha, a couple more questions for you, please, about civics education. How much variation do you see among school districts, Martha, in terms of what civics is required versus what civics is offered?
Well, there's a great deal of inequity in what is offered to students, in particular elementary school. You know, there obviously are dedicated social studies teachers and in middle and high school, at the middle and high school level, but oftentimes the middle school teachers are asked to help out with language arts. Many elementary school teachers have never really taken a government course except perhaps in high school. So there's that. And then there's also the high stakes testing that has been the case, been in effect really for the past 10 years or so, that has caused schools and administrators and teachers to focus on math and literacy, which are obviously very important. But when you think about the subject that's most associated with the health and future of our republic, seems like it's deserving of some time and support.
Well, and Martha, I got to let you go because we are going to take a very quick break. We appreciate you being with us, though. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Martha Mattson. She's the executive director for the New Hampshire Institute for Civics Education. So coming up, we'll look at how new American citizens understand civics and their rights, especially in an election year. All that plus your questions. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Nobody deserves to be hungry, and we've got the opportunity to change that.
Eileen Laponis is the executive director of the New Hampshire Food Bank, a longtime partner of NHPR.
Well, much like NHPR, we have a responsibility to reach every corner of the state. We're trying to further our impact and not just feed the hunger, but nourish the health, and together we do that.
Become an NHPR sustainer today at $13 a month and choose to give 13 meals to help feed local families in need at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, How America Works. That's the subtitle of the new book by NHPR's Civics 101 hosts, Nick Capodice and Hannah McCarthy. It's called A User's Guide to Democracy. For new Americans, learning a different type of government from the national level all the way down to local involvement, The system can be confusing, even intimidating. And so we turn now to Eva Castillo. She's the director of the New Hampshire Alliance for Immigrants and Refugees. In 2016, she received the Americanism Award from the Daughters of the American Revolution, given to naturalized Americans who show outstanding civic engagement. Eva, a big welcome back. It's great to have you.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
So with just weeks before the general election, Eva, voting is on a lot of people's minds. What might make the voting process more difficult for recent immigrants or first-time voters who speak English as a second language, Eva?
Well, the system was hard to navigate to begin with. And now with the addition of COVID, it makes it even harder for people to register, to go figure out how to vote by mail. It is really hard to find the correct information, because wherever you look, they give you a little different information here and there. So it has become really a headache.
Yeah, you know, I helped my college age son with the absentee ballot before he went off to college. And as a native English speaker, I had to go over it three or four times myself, Eva.
Yeah.
What resources are there for people who don't speak English as a second language, recognizing that it's confusing even for native English speakers?
There's nothing. We wrote to the Secretary of State as part of the Multicultural Committee in Manchester, asking him at least translate the materials from your office so that into the main languages, so that people have access to them. And he very politely said, no, you don't have 5% of the population. Therefore, we're not obligated to do so. So, you know, just the fact that you're not obligated to do so doesn't mean that you should not do it. So trying to scramble, yeah, you know, pretty much.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Eva. How are you hoping to get around that?
Well, we're just picking pieces here and there and assembling our own materials and calling people and letting them know. We have an informal group of people that work in the wards, at least here in Manchester, with the Latino community, which is my community. And we volunteer and we sit all day long at the polls and bring people to their homes if they need to, you know, go pick them up and bring them to the polls and help them register if they need to be registered. We're, you know, because we cannot do party politics. We try to just stay clear of the partisan issue and just allow people to make up their own minds. But, you know, my goal is to have people vote not by the party, but based on what their morals and their interests are. I want educated voters. And so, you know, it has been very hard, because even in the parties, it's hard to figure out what the stances are. And, you know, there's a lack of bilingual
information for voters.
Yep.
And here's a golden opportunity for you, Eva. We have a lot of listeners on the exchange who volunteer to work at the polls. Every time we talk about voting, we hear from lots of people who either work at the polls during elections. We have a lot of people who are municipal clerks and town moderators who listen to this show. They often call in. So what's your message for those folks, Eva, the people who are kind of working the polls?
Well, first of all, be more welcoming towards other cultures so that people feel comfortable volunteering or working there. Secondly, I've heard a lot of complaints about certain wards that are not so friendly. They, you know, and I understand it must be, you know, hard to communicate with somebody with limited English proficiency. But, you know, courtesy doesn't have a language. And people lose their patience and they end up being kind of abrasive when it comes to helping people registering if they cannot understand them. I personally have, you know, work in Ward 5 in Manchester that's very diverse and people are very friendly there. And I am able to communicate even with African people with very limited just by being patient and sitting down. So, you know, be courteous.
More broadly, Eva, beyond voting, what are some of the most confusing aspects of American democracy for new Americans, and how come?
Well, we come from countries where really, you know, majority rules. And here we have this electoral college that really, to even myself, it doesn't really make any sense to me. So it's hard to understand for people, you know, the roles. It's hard to understand the roles of the officers. Like, a lot of people have no clue what the executive counselor does. A lot of people have no clue what the office of the register does. So there are a lot of names on the ballot with roles that people have no clue what they're voting for and what those roles entail.
Wow. And that is something I'm going to talk to the Civics 101 team in just a few minutes, because you're right. There are some of those lower tier offices that people have no idea. Lots of people have no idea what those offices are all about. Confusing for lots of voters, not just new Americans. Any last thoughts, Eva, that you want to leave with us before we let you go today?
I just want to send a message to our elected officials and to the community in general, that New Hampshire is becoming a more diverse state. We're not going to go back to being, you know, a non-94% white state. We're becoming very diverse, and we're not going back. So let's adapt. Let's figure out how to make sure that every single person that has the right to vote does so in an easy way. And let's make sure that we become, you know, a welcoming community for everybody, where we all can thrive and make our state a better place.
Eva, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Eva Castillo. She's the director of the New Hampshire Alliance for Immigrants and Refugees. And listeners, by the way, we know you have lots of questions and comments about voting this year. We've done whole shows on this. We are definitely planning more. But in the meantime, we have lots of resources and information on our website. It's nhpr.org/elections2020. Right now, as we talk about Civics 101 with the hosts of our podcast by that name and the co-authors of a new book, we welcome your questions and comments about some of the aspects of our democracy that maybe are not clear to all of us. Your questions are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email is great. That's exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can use Facebook. And Nick, it was so interesting to hear Eva say that a lot of new Americans don't understand the Electoral College. I think this is a complicated topic for new Americans and native born alike. Nick, you've got a whole section in your book about the Electoral College and the whole election process. So why don't you start off with that, Nick, please? How was the Electoral College established and why?
Okay, that's a great place to start. Thank you, Laura. So why? Well, it was sort of the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton, star of Broadway and many other things. The Electoral College was sort of placed as a bulwark, like a barrier between the people and the person we elect for president. Because contrary to maybe what some of us believe, the framers didn't really, weren't huge fans of democracy, lowercase d democracy. They were sort of sometimes referred to it as mobocracy, a little afraid that the quote unquote uneducated person who votes won't really have enough knowledge to know who they're electing. So they wanted to prevent something from happening. They wanted to prevent sort of a tyrannical polemicist, somebody who's just play into the will of the people to become the president through who somebody who campaigns on lies, someone who dupes the American voting populace, because they won't have enough knowledge to stop themselves from voting for them. So they created this barrier, which was people who were quote unquote men of virtue, who could see the virtue in others, who could be the people in charge of actually picking the president to prevent us from being taken over from a tyranny such as that. Now, the really important thing, maybe the most important thing to know about the Electoral College at its founding, right, at the beginning of our nation's founding, is that there was this huge question of representation, which is like, how many electors for each state do we send, right? How many electors from each state count? And, it's determined on your population. So if your state's got more people, you get more representatives that are sent to the House. Because by the way, The electoral votes your state gets is the number of people that you send to Congress. So here in New Hampshire, we have two reps, we have two congressional districts, and we have two senators. Therefore, we have four electoral votes. California's got 55 electoral votes because they send 53 people to the House and they have two senators. But at the very beginning, there was this question of how do we count the people who don't vote in terms of representation. I'm talking enslaved Americans and women and other minorities, people who weren't allowed to vote, but who were here. The agreement was called the Three-Fifths Compromise, which is one of the places where we enshrine the institution of slavery in our U.S. Constitution, which counts enslaved Americans as three-fifths of a person in terms of apportioning out representatives for the state. This was, without a doubt, a huge gift to the South. Maybe it's no coincidence that seven out of our first 10 presidents were Southern slaveholders, because you have this massive block of people who count towards your electoral votes, but you have a much smaller, much more elite group of white males who own land who actually can vote. And as the years go by, the Electoral College has always favored one party or location over the other.
Very interesting. So, Hannah, what is most confusing for people to figure out about this? Again, you know, Ava said it's confusing for new Americans. I think it's confusing for most Americans. So go ahead, Hannah.
Yeah, I think what's probably most confusing, and I know that when I was first learning about the Electoral College in school, I remember coming home and saying to my mother that it just seemed really unfair, because how could it be that you could have a popular vote? How could it be that you could have the majority of American people choosing one person, and the Electoral College resulted in the choice of another? And it's a really good question, and it's debated to this day. This is why the popular vote movement is catching fire in a lot of states. And you know, I don't have a good answer to that. It is confusing. It's just simply the way that it goes, that you have, you know, California, Texas, and Illinois providing 113 electoral votes, you know, and then New York, by comparison, doesn't get as much love. I mean, it just feels, the distribution feels a little unfair. And of course, the census always affects how that's going to work out. You're going to see electoral college distribution shift when the census shifts, because it's all based on population and representation. I think because we've got this mathematical formula that can be a little unwieldy, it can really feel perhaps that you are a bit disempowered in casting your vote. And the truth is that in some cases, well, that's true.
In terms of the presidential vote, right, exactly. Hannah? So if you're a Republican in Massachusetts or a Democrat in Kansas, your vote for president is probably going to be wiped out by the majority in your state. But that's not an argument not to vote, Hannah, right?
Absolutely not. And I'm so glad that you brought this up, Laura. So my favorite argument against anybody, and I have friends who say, for example, I have a lot of friends in Massachusetts, I have a lot of friends in New York, and they say, well, I just don't really see the point of my voting because it's just falling into this pool. These are people who identify as Democrats, right? And my friends who identify as Republican feel a bit differently, or don't, because they're in a state that swings so far in one direction or another. And they might say, because I'm just sort of dropping my vote into this giant ocean, I'm not really having a say. What's the point of actually turning up and voting? And I would say, well, fine, perhaps go ahead and be disillusioned. You know, that's fine. Perhaps your vote is not.
Don't tell me about it, but yeah.
It's not going to necessarily make a difference in the presidential election. But actually, where your vote is going to make a difference is at the level that's going to make the most difference in your life. Because you're not just voting for the president, you're also voting for state and local officials who are making decisions, not just about the day-to-day operations of your life, but also about how voting works in your state. So if you feel disempowered about the way that voting works in your state, you better show up and vote so that you can decide who is in charge of making those rules. And another thing that I think can be a fairly compelling argument, if you out there, listener, are trying to convince someone who thinks that their vote is meaningless, when you show up and vote, you add some numbers to your demographic, right? If you get all your friends who perhaps identify within the same demographic group as you to show up and vote, you know, 18 to 24 year old Latinx individuals, right? What you are doing is telling people in charge of campaigns and politicians that your demographic matters because you showed up and you made your voice heard. Now, they might not have been paying attention to you in the last election, but you can bet that because your numbers were so high in this election, they are going to devote attention to you. They're going to pay attention to the issues that you care about because they want to convince you to vote for their candidate. So that's how you shift laws in your favor. That's how you shift attention in your favor, by showing up and saying, hey, my demographic matters. Better pay attention to us.
Taking the long view there. And that's Hannah McCarthy, one of the co-hosts of NHPR's Civics 101. The other co-host, Nick Capodice, is with us as well. So, Nick, I wanted to ask you about something that Hannah just touched on, all those lower level offices. And Ava Castillo said the same thing. What about those lesser known local offices that we'll see on our ballot in November, Nick? County sheriff, registrar of probate. I'm not really sure what that one is. I have a vague idea. I kind of know what the sheriff does. How do people understand these, Nick?
Frankly, not well at all. And it's not anybody's fault. I mean, I swear every time I get into the ballot, there is the voting booth, there's something that I hadn't done my research on beforehand. So what's crucial, the first thing everybody who's listening has to do is to print up a copy of your ballot if it's out already. Because I think it should be for New Hampshire on Ballotpedia, but print out a copy of your ballot, or just look at that on your computer screen, and then do some research on the candidates and the positions that are there. So Register of Deeds is, those are just the people who are in charge of our documents, like our birth records and our death records and who owns property. It's not a political office, frankly, but you know, you can probably envision ways where certain aspects of it can touch upon your life. Sheriff is another thing that's just crucial to do research on, because right now we are at a reckoning and talking about how we consider police power. So if you see the candidates who are on the ballot for sheriff, do your research and see if it aligns with your personal political beliefs on how the role of policing should continue in the state. No matter what you do, though, like the most important thing, and I'm just reiterating it because it's one of the strongest points, Hannah mentioned it, is people who complain that they're not being listened to by people in power, and they don't vote, that is the reason why. If you vote in good numbers, you're going to start getting listened to.
I have been wondering, Nick, whether more people will start paying attention and researching those sheriff's offices. You know, I myself, I have to admit, don't look into it deeply. But now, given this reckoning that you're talking about, I wonder if people will start to look at the positions of these sheriff candidates.
I mean, I think they are. Hannah, I forget the exact number, but like, so one of the reasons we started the show was for civics education. And the interest in that has been growing since the Trump presidency. I'll say that.
Well, and perfect segue again for after a break, Nick, because we will talk a little bit about the origins of Civics 101, the podcast, and also what you guys hope this new book offers. So all that's coming up, plus more of your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, How America Works. That's the subtitle of a new book by the NHPR's Civics 101 podcast team, Nick Capodice and Hannah McCarthy. It's called A User's Guide to Democracy, and we're talking about all the civics lessons right in front of us these days. And Nick and Hannah, more broadly, you have been at this for some time with the podcast, educational programs that you guys do, and now the book. And hand to you first, what's the one thing that you've discovered along the way that a lot of people just don't understand, Hannah?
That's interesting. I mean, there's so much, Laura.
There's probably a lot, but
I think what I found most fascinating, actually, when we first started the podcast, I believe the number was around 32-33% of Americans polled by the Annenberg Public Policy Center could not name the three branches of government.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
23%.
23%
even lower.
Started.
Yeah.
Okay.
Staggering.
Yeah. And one thing I have to say, just as Nick was saying before the break, is that that number has been on the up and up. I believe in the most recent poll, if we want to talk about what has been going on in 2020 and whether or not people are paying more attention, I believe it's up now to 51 or 52%. So things are really changing. People are truly paying attention. I mean, that's like a 30% leap in just a few years. But it's, you know, more broadly, we made a podcast about the very basics of democracy because so many of those things I think feel obscure to a lot of us, even if we know that the three branches of government are the executive, judicial, and legislative branches. We don't necessarily understand how those work. We don't necessarily know how a bill becomes a law, even if we vaguely remember the Schoolhouse Rock song. I think it really these bedrock principles that a lot of us are missing. And you get to a point possibly in adulthood where you're too embarrassed to ask, right? You're not gonna necessarily admit to your kid that you have no idea what the Secretary of Defense does, nor do you necessarily know that the Department of Defense is the largest employer in the world, I believe, Nick, is that correct?
Yeah,
and where the money is going and all of that. So I think the answer is what we don't know are the very basics. And what we're less likely to interrogate are the very basics because it seems like they should be easy. It seems like maybe you vaguely know them. And the minute you take, 10 minutes to actually read a chapter about them or listen to a podcast about them, I think that it illuminates our democracy and makes it so much more accessible and so much less intimidating.
Yeah.
What do you think, Nick? What do most people have the hardest time wrapping their heads around?
Well, I mean, I just got to just sort of jump on what Hannah said and said, frankly, everything. And this is not a cop out of an answer.
Sure.
When I started working with the show, Hannah and I weren't the original hosts of the show. It was the beloved and wonderful Virginia Prescott. I started working in education and Hannah was doing some other reporting on the side. I wanted to find something that would sort of a primer for everything because I was like, oh God, I'm going to start working on the show about civics. I really got to get a refresher on everything, right? Because the world is full of hot takes. It always has been, at least has been since the internet and continues to be. People, in my experience, are frankly scared of talking about these basics because our current political discourse requires a baseline understanding of so many governmental processes, right? So if you don't have a willingness, if you're scared to admit that you don't know about something, that's what the show was created for. That's what our book was written for, right? We don't want to shame anybody for not understanding these processes. We were trying to encourage people to own up and to get smarter about it and then to be a well-informed political person who can take down that next hot take that you hear at a bar or a cafe from somebody who is maybe misquoting something. And there's a lot of people out there, my goodness, a lot of people out there who are just champing at the bit to dress someone down for missing one tiny little thing, for making something. So in terms of what's most complicated, I would say, how a bill really becomes a law is to me still extremely complicated. And I hate to sort of give the cynical answer versus skeptical of sort of, only things that become laws are things that lobbyists, push our elected officials to do. That's not 100% accurate. But the firm truth of it is that a little less than 3% of proposed bills do become law. And the vast majority of those are, things agreed upon, unanimously agreed upon things like naming a post office or something sort of not really that affects our lives like that. Some consider that a feature, like the gentleman who called in earlier, I believe his name is David, and some consider that a bug. Both ways, you can't have it both ways, but that's just the way things go.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email if you'd like. It's exchange@nhpr.org. And, Hannah, as you talked about the podcast and how you hope to have this sort of non-judgy approach to what people don't know, and there is a lot to know. I mean, I've been in journalism for a long time and looking at your book, there's a lot that I didn't know. What are you trying to do with this book that's different from the podcast, Hannah?
Yeah, I think what this book allowed us to do is to go a little bit deeper on everything. With the podcast, you know, that's audio storytelling. There's only so much that you can write about. There are only so many tangents you can go on. And in the book, we had the freedom of as many footnotes as we wanted or that the publisher allowed us to have. I think we cut about half of the footnotes. But it really, I think, let us get into the sort of murkier details of things. For example, the chapter on federalism, I think as Nick mentioned earlier, I went on at length because while I sure in the past had done an episode about federalism, it was still a bit confusing to me. It is a you know, huge unwieldy topic, how state and federal power is separated. And so I spent a very long time laying out the history. But you know, part of that is also trying to make these subjects as fun as possible because they do seem so inaccessible. So we had the freedom too of injecting some humor wherever we could. And we had the great pleasure of working with a New Yorker cartoonist, Tom Toro. So, you know, if you're a little bit intimidated by the Electoral College, we've got a handful of cartoons that accompany that. If you're the kind of person who peruses the New Yorker just for the cartoons, which I was for years, Laura, that's an easy access point, I think, to the book as well. But we're just trying to make it less intimidating while also giving someone as full a picture at the basic level as possible.
Yeah, and the pictures are great. And as you said, by Tom Toro. So it's a lot of fun and kind of digesting it into easy to bite off pieces. For listeners, Nick, who don't know much about podcasts and aren't in the habit and haven't gotten around to getting the book yet, how can they find your show, Nick?
Oh, yeah, that's, you know, easy as pie. Like, so if you've got a smartphone, you can listen to this at any time. And I'm going to guess the majority of our listeners do have a smartphone somewhere in their house. If it's an Apple phone, it just comes with an app pre-installed, just called Apple Podcasts. And you just type Civics 101 in there and you can see our backlog of hundreds of episodes that we've put together. If you want to listen to it on the web while you bop around the kitchen and do dishes, it's just civics101podcast.org is the website to go to. And if you have a non-Apple phone, there's just dozens of apps for listening to podcasts. So that's why that's why people say all the time, or wherever you get your podcast, because there's so many ways to get it. We're also on Spotify. There are myriad ways. And of course, all free. My heavens, all free as a bird. But if you go on the website, you can get transcripts of our episodes. You can see some educational materials that are paired with our episodes. There's a lot more that on the website than on the podcast app.
Well, and actually, that's a perfect chance for me to let our listeners know, Nick, that for people who are kind of intimidated by that, or wherever you get your podcasts, and they think, I'm not really sure what that means.
I don't know where I get it.
I did about a year ago a little tutorial on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And it's basically kind of like you guys with Civics 101. It's not judgy. It just says, if you have no idea what this is about or how to do it, I'm going to walk you through it. So if listeners want to listen to your podcast, just go to the Exchange's website, nhpr.org/exchange. And I've got a little tutorial there that will walk you through it in a very non-judgy way. So there it
Thank
is.
Thank you for that, Laura.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So Hannah and Nick, and Hannah, you first perhaps, what's been the most fun episode or one of the most fun episodes that you've worked on where you just really felt educated and jazzed and maybe even you and Nick had a laugh or two? What would you say, Hannah?
Oh, I would say probably the most oft revisited joke has to do with the beginning of my Magna Carta episode.
Wow.
And I started with the high Middle Ages, Laura, and I just went from there. That was one of the most fun episodes for me to make. So when we were thinking about the founding documents and what our, you know, what are our basic principles, what are our foundational ideas, it was, I can't remember which of us came up with it, but we realized that the notion of trial by jury, there are whiffs of it way back in Magna Carta, when you had barons petitioning the king for certain rights. And it was just this moment to go way far back into history before, you know, America was even a notion to the European world, and find that there were these democratic-ish principles way back when, which, you know, when our framers were crafting the Constitution, they looked to what had preceded them. They were smart individuals, but they didn't come up with all of it on their own. It had to do with a lot of other brilliant philosophers and governors and thinkers who had preceded them. So to locate one of these foundational principles way back when, not just trial by jury, but also the notion that the person who's in charge of your nation is not above the law. That can be found way back when in Magna Carta, and that is absolutely essential to American democracy, to any democracy, to any functioning power by the people government. So that was a real pleasure for me to make. And it's sort of heartening to see that these ideas, there are echoes of these ideas far, far back in history before we began our democratic experiment.
Oh, that's great. And that was part of your series on the founding documents, right?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. And that's the best description of the Magna Carta I've heard in a long time. It was democratic-ish. So, Nick, how about you? What episode really jumps out to you? And maybe we'll entice people listening to, you know, check that episode out first. Yeah. Which one sort of brought you the most pleasure?
Well, I'm going to have to go with the difference between the House and the Senate, which is was one of our, so the show initially when Virginia was hosting, it was sort of what we call a two-way in the radio world, which is one person asking another person questions. And it was a great format. Virginia was tremendous at it. I was not. frankly, Hannah and I tried to do that sort of model for the show and we weren't terribly successful at it. So then we got permission and worked with producers to try to, and our boss, to sort of rethink the show in a more narrative format. So it's, each episode tells a story and has sound design. Midterm edition, House v. Senate, was the first one of those. I got to play some bompin' house music for the House and people screaming, and some lovely symphonic music for the Senate with people very quietly speaking. So listen to that one if you want to have a laugh.
I really liked that one. I remember that, Nick. And congratulations on the book, guys. And,
thank you,
Laura.
Really appreciate you being with us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure, Laura.
That's Nick Capodice and Hannah McCarthy, co-hosts of NHPR's Civics 101 podcast and co-authors of the brand new book, A User's Guide to Democracy, How America Works. Again, you can find more information, including how to get a podcast, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Today's show was produced by Christina Phillips with help from Jessica Hunt, and you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.